Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ask yourself this as you think about the European debt crisis. All those dollars being used to prop up banks over there, where are they coming from? The Federal Reserve as the world's lender of last resort on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by the Epson Workforce Pro, engineered for productivity to deliver high-speed automatic two-sided color printing, copying, scanning, and faxing. The Epson Workforce Pro. Learn more at Epson.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 1st of December. Good to have you with us. And let's review the big economic stories of the past 24 hours as a way to set the scene today. The world's biggest central bankers have agreed to make it easier, that is cheaper, for European banks to get dollars. They've done so in the hopes that that will unstick the gummed up credit markets over there. But step back for just a second. Where are they going to get those dollars? Yes, the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. And what does the Fed get for its troubles? Euros. The currency whose very future is in no small amount of doubt. The Fed says it's only agreed to a temporary swap of dollars for euros, which will be true if things go according to plan. If they don't, well, here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Risk advisor Christopher Whalen says the U.S. hasn't learned from history. He says we bailed out Europe after both world wars, only to have the Europeans default. He's not impressed the Fed is taking euros as collateral.
What if there's no euro a year from now? You just had the U.K. tell its banks yesterday to prepare for the end of the euro. So the Fed could be holding worthless currency, and the Europeans may just default, as they have before.
Not only that, should the euro tank, the Fed might not even be able to sell its euros. So says Frederick Sheehan, the author of several books on the Fed. He's suspicious of the Fed's reassurances that we'll hold euros for whatever dollars we swap with the European Central Bank.
That is a half-truth. We hold them, but they are sitting in a reserve account at the ECB. We do not have possession of them.
Sheehan says Ben Bernanke's past venture with a $500 billion euro swap in 2008 raised some questions. Florida Democrat Alan Grayson pressed the Fed chairman at a congressional hearing and learned Bernanke hadn't kept track of where the bailout went.
So who got the money?
Financial institutions in Europe and other countries.
Which ones?
I don't know.
$500 billion and you don't know who got the money?
In the end, the U.S. was paid back with interest, and there are legal protections built into this deal. But Sheehan says the banking crisis then was small compared to shaky national economies.
Now the sovereigns are at risk, and they cannot ultimately provide enough currency to protect themselves.
Risk expert Christopher Whalen worries if the Fed doesn't eventually get all those dollars back, we'll all feel the effects.
Not so much that, you know, the Fed's going to go out of business because it loses money, but the real impact on consumers is higher inflation. And the cost is going to hit you right in the pocketbook in terms of what your dollar can buy.
Whalen says that pain could linger for years. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
As long as we're talking about central banks, here's one more name to throw out there that you're going to be hearing more of as the European crisis gets worse, if it gets worse. Mario Draghi is the head of the European Central Bank, and here's why I bring him up. He said in a speech today that he would be willing to step up and do more, that is, buy up some of the bad sovereign debt that's out there, on one condition, that the 17 governments that use the euro tie themselves more closely together economically. That in turn gets us to Monday and German Chancellor Angela Merkel's upcoming trip to Paris. Yet another round of emergency talks about saving the eurozone with French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Merkel has been taking her time deciding whether and how much she'll spend to rescue the euro. In fact, there was a great quote the other day from the Polish foreign minister. Radek Sikorski is his name. Here's what he said. I will probably be the first Polish foreign minister in history to say this, but here it is. I fear, he said, German power less than I am beginning to fear its inactivity. So we asked Marketplace's Stephen Beard to assess the mood in the German capital.
In order to explain this complicated mess, the media have resorted to metaphor. The euro is a ship, holed below the waterline and sinking as the crew bickers over who should bail it out. Or the euro is a train and some of its carriages have gone off the rails. But among the commuters we spoke to at Grand Central Station in Berlin this morning, there seemed little sense of an impending euro disaster, although Martin Pluter was a little worried about disunity in Europe
Yeah, I do have some concerns because I think the euro is very important for Europe to be united.
And Beate Gracher, a music teacher, was not happy about Europe looking to Germany to solve the crisis.
I'm angry about the future. Why? Every time the Germans, and so we have fear that they all want our money.
They do want your money. Germany is the only country in the eurozone with deep enough pockets to save the euro, and it does need saving. Time for another metaphor. Ferdinand Fischner of the DIW think tank in Berlin says the euro has had a heart attack.
Clearly, Europe is on the operating table and needs an urgent surgery.
But he says Dr. Merkel and her team are not wielding the scalpel but drawing up a diet and a program of exercise so the patient doesn't have a future attack.
Clearly, Merkel is focusing on the future structure and the future workings of the euro area.
She wants her European partners to sign up to strictly binding limits on the amount of debt they can run up in future. They want instant solutions. They're not going to get them from Merkel, says commentator Heinz Schulte.
What she will not do, it seems to me, is to give the European Central Bank carte blanche to print money. That would be against the German grain, I'm sure of it.
Printing money equals hyperinflation equals the turmoil that led to Hitler. That's the grim equation from German history. Merkel's apparent dithering reflects her voters' reluctance, especially when it comes to putting more money into Germany's southern neighbours. The country's already committed to lending them $280 billion. Constanze Stelzenmüller is with the German Marshall Fund of the US.
I think there is a sense right now that we keep being asked to pay and pay and pay.
But she concedes Merkel's inaction and the market's turbulence are raising anxiety levels among policymakers in Berlin.
You can sense the tension in this town. You can sense a fear that people might not get their act together in time for this. And the time factor is crucial because clearly the markets are very impatient.
As a schoolgirl, so the story goes, Angela Merkel once spent an entire swimming lesson perched on a diving board. Only at the end of the lesson did she finally take the plunge. Ferdinand Fischner worries now about a repeat performance.
There is probably a danger that she might jump in too late.
And if she does, the euro could be sunk, and not metaphorically. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There was no rosy afterglow on Wall Street from yesterday's central bank cashapalooza. Traders seemed a bit skittish as they digested the news. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Warren Buffett has decided he wants to buy the world. Yeah, no, not this world, at least not today. We're talking about the Omaha World Herald Company, which publishes seven local newspapers, including Buffett's hometown daily of the same name. Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway is its name, is going to put up $150 million to get the deal done. And it's a pretty surprising move, actually, because Buffett has made it clear he doesn't much believe in newspapers as an investment. Or maybe regional papers are more resilient than we think. Sally Herships has more.
How does Craig Newmark sleep at night? That's what newspaper publishers ask themselves, right? The newspaper industry is dying, and it's all the fault of sites like, well, Craigslist.
Because Classifieds was the leading profit center for most newspapers, and it is no longer.
Peter Zollman is an advertising consultant. He says sites like Craigslist, CareerBuilder, and Monster.com have hurt newspapers, but they certainly aren't killing them.
Because believe it or not, despite what you've heard, newspaper advertising still works very well.
And I don't think you see Macy's and stores on Craigslist.
Ed Adorino is a media analyst with the Benchmark Company. He says big publishers like Gannett, which owns a lot of regional newspapers, are still making money.
Still making a lot of money, as a matter of fact. The trouble is it's making less money quarter to quarter.
Adorino says the real problem for newspapers is shrinking circulation. They aren't attracting a lot of new readers, and they're losing the older ones earlier. After all, newspapers used to be the place you went for news, and now there's a lot of competition. But not for all news. Jim Goss is a media analyst with Barrington Research.
The Omaha paper probably owns the Omaha content in a way that is not likely going to be replicated by somebody out of Virginia.
And there's not much incentive for somebody from Topeka to cover Omaha. And keeping Omaha covered may be the real reason Buffett is buying the Omaha World. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Epson Workforce Pro, the world's fastest two-sided inkjet printer. Engineered for productivity, it delivers high-speed automatic two-sided color printing, copying, scanning, and faxing to keep your business running at full speed. With extra high-capacity ink cartridges, the Workforce Pro helps you save on ink. It prints from mobile devices like smartphones and tablets fast and easy. Check it out at Epson.com.
If you're fortunate enough, or perhaps unfortunate enough, given the way the market's going, to own a home in this country, you know from bureaucracy. The mortgage application, the appraisals, the stacks of paperwork, and endless possibilities for unhappy surprises come closing time. Yeah, but count your blessings, because that's nothing compared to the ordeal of buying a house on a Native American reservation. From our series Economy 4.0, Marketplace's David Brancaccio looks at what it takes to become a homeowner in Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
Buying a house, that wobbly pillar of the American dream, is even more fraught in a place like Pine Ridge. After hundreds of years of treaties, a number of them broken, the reservation is a patchwork. Some land is private, some of it is held in trust by the feds, and some belongs to extended families. So when Lambert Hawk decided to move back after decades of high prices and quakes out in California, he ran into a frustrating legacy: red tape. It started when he and his wife, Mary, put their names on a wait list with the Oglala Lakota Tribal Housing Authority. And then they waited.
I didn't know, you know, that they turned me down, but they wouldn't let me know. They just said, come back next year and put another application in. And all the time, I just, you know, as soon as I left, they probably threw it in the trash.
The wait lists for housing here are crazy long, sometimes 25 years before you get a home. People have died waiting. Fed up, Hawk contacted Emma Pinky Clifford.
Hello.
Clifford runs a nonprofit called the Partnership for Housing. It's working with the local housing authority to make buying a house, well, easier. Driving around with Clifford, visitors are struck with the vastness of the reservation, as big as the states of Delaware and Rhode Island stitched together. The housing crisis here is not from a lack of open space.
She's not behind a big old tractor.
What's weird is that everyone seems to already own a parcel of land, inherited from treaties or long-gone ancestors. But the land has been split, chopped, and divided. Fractionation, they call it. That makes ownership tough to prove. Some people don't even know where their land is or how many others share ownership. Think of a pie, says Clifford.
And we cut it into six pieces, and I had six children and 12 grandchildren. Each child would get a wedge, and they would have to split that wedge with their kids. It's very, very tiny.
That, combined with the difficulty of putting in services like sewage or electricity to these dispersed bits of land, it means that most people on Pine Ridge live packed into suburban-like cul-de-sacs where crime flourishes.
I come home depressed about every night where the need that's out there. It's great.
Paul Ironcloud, director of tribal housing, says he needs 4,000 additional houses to meet the needs of the reservation's 45,000 residents. That's something he says is the federal government's responsibility, spelled out in treaties.
Those treaties are good as long as the grass grows and the rivers flow. You know, that means forever.
He says since the government took pretty much everything from the Lakota Indians, the feds are supposed to take care of people's needs. These days, that means 1,200 low-rent, government-built housing units, which are now generally overcrowded and falling apart. But Lambert and Mary Hawk, the couple who moved back from California, had something many of their neighbors did not have in a reservation that's one of the very poorest places in America. The Hawks had some savings, and they used this savings to buy a little green house. Happy ending? Not quite. There was a catch.
We're leasing the land, the lot, I guess. We can't buy it. So we're just leasing it from the tribe. But I don't know what the deal was, waiting list, or they couldn't do it or something, you know.
So the house is now theirs, but not the land underneath because of the reservation's complex rules. That means the property is not that useful as a financial asset if they would ever want to borrow against the house or use it to trade up to something with more space. They joke about maybe separating the house they now own from the land they don't.
if we want, we could just pick the house up, move it.
Somebody did it next door.
Next door, you see that open. Uh-huh. I guess somebody bought the house and just
picked it up, moved it. Yeah. To their land.
A group of not-for-profits is now working with the Oglala Sioux tribe to try to streamline the way the reservation is managed, reforms that could someday bring more order to buying a place to live. I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Coming up, in technology, sometimes bad is good.
The crappy stuff just has a way of sticking around.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so the euphoria lasted about 24 hours. Markets ended the day mixed. The Dow Industrials gave back 25 points, 0.2%, closed at 12,020. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, 0.2%, finished at 2626. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points, about a 0.1%, ended things at 1244. News that consumers shopped it up in November lifted a number of retail stocks. Shares of warehouse discounter Costco rose 0.2%. Upmarket department store Nordstrom rang up a 4% gain. Target, though, missed its mark. Shares slid 1%. Yoga wear maker Lululemon saw its shares tumble 5%, couldn't keep up with the demand for its popular clothing. Citigroup shares debited 1.7% today. JPMorgan Chase said 1.6%. Long-suffering Bank of America caught a break. Its shares picked up 1.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.09%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for November. A House Ways and Means subcommittee opens a series of hearings on the future of the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. And President Obama hosts the White House Tribal Nations Conference. Leaders from more than 500 federally recognized tribes are expected to attend. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a manufacturing report out today from a group known as ISM, the Institute for Supply Management. It's a monthly thing they do, a look at how busy American factories are. More busy in November than a month earlier, it's nice to be able to say. But manufacturing in this country is changing, because it has to. So imagine, if you will, leaving the office after a long day. Place is empty, but your computer keeps doing your job. That's the basic idea behind a growing trend in some U.S. factories called lights-out machining. From the public media project Changing Gears, Kate Davidson reports.
It's 5:30 p.m., and I'm standing in a dimly lit machine shop called Hard Milling Solutions, north of Detroit. The staff has gone home for the night, and I'm the only human here. But all around me, machines are working, carving intricate metal molds. This is manufacturing's new night shift. No workers required. Now let's rewind a couple hours so you can meet Corey Greenwald. He started this company in 2004, and he's kind of a lights-out evangelist.
The great thing about these machines, they don't take holiday, they don't take breaks, and they don't write grievances, you know?
The molds and dies machined here make plastic parts for cars and for people. Parts like artificial hips and knees. The process is much cheaper. In the old days, running 5 milling machines over 3 shifts employed 15 workers. Now, Greenwald's shop only needs 4. He says people have told him for decades that automation would cost jobs.
You know what? They were right. They were absolutely right. What they didn't know is it wasn't going to be their biggest enemy. Their enemy was going to be developing countries around the world that had really cheap labor.
There aren't yet statistics about the scope of lights-out machining, but Debbie Holton with the Society of Manufacturing Engineers sees a trend.
There's really an explosion of lights-out machining in the small and medium-sized manufacturers. They're using this to compensate for the fact that they're having trouble finding skilled workers, they need to get more from less, and they're increasing their productivity with this technology.
Economist Dan Luria says the success of manufacturing should be measured by productivity, not jobs. He heads research at the Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center, which helps smaller manufacturers grow.
Luria says for the U.S. to compete against ultra-low-wage countries, it will have to use less and less labor. He says manufacturing is going the way of agriculture, once labor-intensive, now highly automated.
We've gone from having 30% of the population in agriculture to less than 2% today. Just as it's very unlikely we're going to be able to increase employment in the manufacturing sector, even if we're successful in increasing the sector's output.
Still, not every job can be automated. Take the company Midwest Mold, also north of Detroit. John Hill's 30 employees design and assemble plastic injection molds, and that requires direct labor. The company does use lights out machines to make the parts for those molds.
So we're not doing this to eliminate jobs. We're doing this to get more throughput per employee.
Hill says he spends about $1,200 a month in healthcare benefits per employee. He says using lights out machining helps him pay the wage and benefit costs for the employees that he already has. He says in that way, lights out machining actually saves jobs.
If I was more, you know, it's all about me, I could get rid of five more guys and buy two more machines and say life is good. But it's hard to tell somebody they don't have a place here anymore.
John Hill says one day he'd like to walk away from this job because he's retiring, not because his company couldn't compete enough to survive. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Despite my best efforts on the show this past Cyber Monday, I didn't wind up buying anything. Didn't buy on Black Friday, or in the wee hours of Thanksgiving night either, for that matter. Because the truth is, there's nothing I really need, and no sense spending money you don't have to spend, yes? That's music to the ears of Thomas Hayden, whose recent essay extols the virtues of hanging on to your old stuff for a while. Except, he doesn't call it old stuff. He calls it, and this is the part that might make you want to turn down the radio for the next 3 minutes and 10 seconds. I'll give you a beat or two to do that. He calls it crap technology. His essay is titled In Praise of Crap Technology. It was on the website Last Word on Nothing a couple of weeks ago. Thomas Hayden, welcome to the program.
Kai, it's a pleasure to be here.
You have to tell me about this piece of crap technology that's your favorite. You brought it with you, right?
Yes, I do have my Kobe MP3 player right here with me. I sort of think of it as sort of the well drink of technology. It's not high-end stuff, but if you're making a margarita, you don't need the best tequila, right? It's just whatever is good enough.
Is it that you don't care about the latest and greatest? You are an anti-Appleite? What is it that keeps you glued to the Kobe?
I love Apple products. I just don't feel that I have to underwrite the advertising budget for Apple computers by paying top dollar for the latest thing. Really, if it works well, crap technology is green technology. I don't have to upgrade because the next version of my Kobe is going to be just as mediocre as the one I have. So I have no pressure to get a new one and throw out the old one. I generate practically no e-waste.
There's a difference, though, right, between crap technology and crappy technology?
Crap technology is basically stuff that doesn't have cachet. You know, it's not slick, it's not cool, but it works. Crappy technology, on the other hand, is stuff that simply doesn't work. That's the sweet spot of crap technology. No cachet, but all the functionality you'll ever need.
I love that phrase, the sweet spot of crap technology. and also, actually, if you lose a $20 piece of crap technology, it's $20 instead of $399.
I got my Kobe after losing my 30-gig iPod. What I discovered, when you have a $20 piece of junk, you don't lose it. When you have a $400 piece of glorious machinery, you do lose it. The crappy stuff just has a way of sticking around.
And then, you know what's funny? When you're doing an interview and you can hear the piece of promo tape, and that was it, right? There, that was the piece of promo tape. One last thing before I let you go. Besides the Kobe, what other pieces of crap technology do you swear by?
I drove to the studio this morning in my 2000 Ford Focus hatchback, well-tuned.
Yeah.
Nobody ever breaks in. Doesn't matter what you have hidden under the seat. I still have the 12-speed racer that I got when I started high school in 1980.
Wow.
It's a Rodace 404, and it simply cannot die. And I take my morning coffee in a mason jar, an old spaghetti sauce jar.
No, come on.
I do. You know
Doesn't
what?
Doesn't it burn your hands, though?
Well, no. Here's the beauty of it. You know, pour your coffee into the mason jar, screw it on tight, you throw it straight into the backpack, ride your bike to the train, hop on the train. By the time you're ready to drink it, it's cooled down to a civilized degree, and you're all set.
Thomas Hayden's essay is called In Praise of Crap Technology. It was on the website Last Word on Nothing. You can find a link on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Thomas, thanks a lot.
Kai, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, if I seem a little bit low energy, like I'm kind of dragging, it's because I slept in the middle of a hurricane last night. Actually, slept is too strong a word because the winds that are hammering parts of Southern California kept the dogs up. They kept the kids up. They turned the lights out. About 250,000 people here are still without power. Shea Rizdahl among them. More Santa Ana winds to come tonight as well. And I know it's not snow or a blizzard or anything like that, but I got to tell you, it's a big deal out here. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, this Thursday. Today, the Dow gave back 25 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, also 0.2%. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points, 0.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up back here tomorrow... Well, let's see. Europe's a mess. Washington's a mess. Wall Street, who the heck knows? Perfect fodder, I'd say, for our weekly wrap. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like...
What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.